and they were the monks were meditating, and the Buddha had left them there, in case you weren't here yesterday and didn't get that part of the story. And everything was like hunky-dory. They were like having a great time out there. And then they started feeling fear, and the fear started increasing. But nobody wanted to say anything to anybody else. So finally, one goes, how's your meditation? I mean, how do you feel being here in this forest? He said, I'm feeling creepy. I'm feeling, you know, I feel fear. Like, I mean, there's the evil spirits in these forests. And so they said, well, we can't stay here. We got to go. And they went back to the Buddha. You know, they didn't drive, so it was a long, long, long walk. When they got to him, they said, we can't stay where you left us because there are evil spirits in those forests. He said, you know, you got to go back. And he said, but on your way back, this is what I want you to recite to yourself. This is what I want you to reflect on. And he gave them the Metta Sutta. May all beings everywhere of all form of, you know, of all two-legged, four-legged, 100 legs, no legs, gross material body, fine form body, immaterial body. God, he like anything that could possibly be living in any realm, in any world. And he talked about may they be well and happy and peaceful. Yeah. And giving loving kindness to them. And by the time they walked back to that forest, it wasn't that anything had changed so much from its own side, but they had changed. And because they had changed, when they came into that environment, they transformed. The environment was transformed. Devas there had said they liked them coming in, but the longer they stayed, the more their bad habits started coming out. You know, the talking about each other and the backbiting, the criticizing, the, you know, all the things that we do in our unenlightened state. He said they were just ready for those monks to go. You go now. You know, now, I know what that's like because I'm building a spiritual community in North Carolina, and you know, everybody wants to come and they want to help, and they come, and after 2 weeks it's like, you go now, you know. Because there's this a rubbing together, and our personality traits start to come out, and it's difficult to tolerate others' stuff coming out, but we don't exactly see our own stuff. And so all of this has to happen. It's like trying to build a building with stones, and you have to like rub them to make them fit tight. I had a friend who was a stonemason. You know, he builds these fireplaces and he doesn't use any mortar. I'm like, what's gonna keep that from falling down? He says, you gotta know how to fit these stones together. You know, and it's truly, truly an art. But it's kind of like we are like that. You know, lively stones have to be fit together and wedged so tightly and shaved off on this edge and cramped over in this corner. But when we finish, we have a building that is substantial and cannot be blown over. And so this is a process. And some... I'm not committed to that process at this time. They didn't realize that this was going to be a process. We're just going to come up here and everybody play kissy face with each other. But it's not really like that. So when you make a decision to go into a spiritual community like that, you know, it's more than meeting people for an hour or a couple of hours a week. When you're with them 24/7 and you didn't say I do, you know, it's a whole different thing. These aren't people that you chose. These aren't people that, you know, that you had time to get to know. You have to do it while you're running, on the fly. And so it's a difficult work. But when we understand that, then we can approach it a little bit better. I can see she's having a bad hair day, so I will just hold my peace today. But then on another day, and one needs to say, sister, can we talk about you know, your response every time I ask you, will you do, you know, assign you a chore? It's something like that. But we have to look and see, when is the right time? And if one is weak, can I be strong today? If I'm weak today, can you be strong? Yeah. And so this is a process. And this is how all of life is. It's the same process. Luckily for you, you don't all live together. So you have a week between times to get over what irritated you. But we often have minutes, because when we finish this, we have to get on to this. And we have to be able to come back together and start anew. And so these teachings are designed for that. That one can, whether they have a long time to get themselves together to regroup, or whether we got short time. And the practice is so that you can, like, just turn and start over. Just turn and start over. And so it's about cultivating a certain attitude, because it's the attitude that really determines the value or the worth of the actions or of the words. It's the underlying attitude. So somebody can say, oh, that's a pretty dress. And I remember I had this polka dot dress my mother bought me. But I was in junior high school. You wear polka dots in elementary school. You do not wear them in junior high school. And she made me wear that dress to school. I knew I was going to be the laughing stock. I really had a crinoline too, I think. You know. And she made me wear that dress. And a girl came up to me and said, oh, that's a pretty dress you have on. And she was like completely, you know, dissing me. And I was so embarrassed, you know. She said the right words, but the underlying, you know, emphasis was entirely different. I wanted a leather coat, because all the single ladies were getting the leather coats, you know, when I was in junior high school. And they were like sleek. They were like cut into four patches, those of you who are old enough to remember when the leather thing hit. I think that was 60 or 58, I'm dating myself now, huh? And so I wanted one. I mean, everybody knew what coat. If you just said you wanted a leather coat, everybody knew. My mother, she gets me one for Christmas. First of all, it wasn't leather, it was pleather. And then it wasn't that sleek cut, you know, that sleek European cut. It was almost like an A-frame with gathers all the way across the top. And I looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy in this plastic coat. And I didn't want to wear it. She said, you asked for this coat, and you're going to wear this coat. So I had to wear the coat to school. Well, at 3 o'clock when I went to get my coat, almost everybody in the school had autographed it. And it hurt so bad. And I didn't wear the coat home. And it was cold. You needed a coat. I didn't wear the coat home. I folded it inside out and on my arm. And when I got home, I laid it on my mother's bed. And we never had a conversation about the coat. I didn't get a new one that was leather. I never had a conversation about the coat. I ended up getting a plaid wool coat, and that was the end of it. And so when we think about things like this, you know, that story is as fresh for me as if it was yesterday. But when I look at it and I see how the Dharma has upended something. First, it uprooted it, and then it upended it for me. That it took the sting out. It took all the pain out. But how many things are we still suffering with, and that we have allowed to make us who we are today based on the things that have happened to us in our life, and we're determined to not let that happen again, or we're still suffering from it. One time I told a story about being raped, and that I knew in a few months that I was going to die if I didn't forgive that man, because it was killing me. The thoughts that I harbored about it, the reliving of it, I was literally going to die. I was consumed with rage. I was burning up. And for my own life, I had to forgive. So about 10 years later, he knocks on my door. He found me in another city 10 years later. And he said, "I came to apologize for what I did to you. And to ask you to forgive me." I said, "I forgave you a long, long time ago, because that's the only way I could go on." He said, "Well, I was in torment and torture for a decade." He said, "I became a psychiatrist to try to understand what made me do that to you." And he said, "I discovered that it's because I felt you took my best friend from me," because my boyfriend and he were best friends. And my boyfriend entrusted him in his care when he had to go somewhere, and he did this to me. And he said, "And I wanted to hurt you, but mostly I wanted to hurt him. And the best way to hurt him was to violate you." And so I said, "Well, now that you've discovered that, I hope you feel better." I said, "But, you know, I know we have to do what we need to do for ourselves. But for me, I'm okay. And I'm glad that you continued with this path to find your own freedom." And that was the end. And that was the end of it. No, and I'm saying, I honestly feel this way. I honestly felt that way. Now, what can make a person feel? So as soon as I told that story, there was another woman, and she also had, you know, had been raped, and she could not accept my forgiving this person. She just couldn't. She said, you know, and she was upset with me for even having a discussion like this. And I understood her, and I understood where she was. I said, "But, you know," and I asked her, you know, what was the outcome, and, you know, she doesn't know, and the person was never apprehended. She was yanked getting off a bus right into an alley, and I said, "You know what?" I said, "I bet you, while you're doing all of this suffering because of your rage, I bet you he's not even thinking about you. I bet you he's not suffering one bit." Yes, it did happen, but it's not happening now. You're reliving it every day, and you are causing yourself suffering. There was that momentary incident where he did something to you. But all the time beyond that, you have to take responsibility for that. But the good news is that we can find a release for whatever happens in our life, if we want it. For some of us, we can't conceive of letting something go. For some of us, we can't conceive of forgiving some actions. But the Buddha doesn't even really talk about forgiveness. Not really. He talks about non-judgment. If you haven't judged, then there's nothing to forgive. So in the beginning, we're working with forgiveness because we have not learned non-judgment. We can discriminate. Discrimination and judgment, different. Discrimination looks at the thing, looks at the act. Judgment defines the person for you. So he says we're looking in the wrong place. We need to like switch just a little bit. I talked about the difference between an understanding person and a hating person is that one has discrimination around the act, but the other judges the person. And in that way, hatred will be, it can never overcome hatred. Hatred can only be overcome by non-hatred. This is a universal law. And we have to be ready to surrender to this universal law, or we will just hit up against it like that. And when we're ready to surrender to it, it doesn't mean at that moment that we agree with it. It is saying at that moment, I will allow myself to be washed with this. And in time, an understanding comes. And that's what produces, you know, like everybody loves the, like a person like maybe Dr. Martin Luther King or someone who's like a great, not the martyrdom part, but who's like giving of themselves, you know? We like to admire them, but we don't want to do that, you know? Because it takes so much. But yet when we start turning our mind in that way, gearing up, being ready for the suffering. I went out to dinner last night with a man, and he had extended an opportunity for a young man, making a way for him in his life when he was like up against an obstacle. And the young man wasn't able to take advantage of the offer. He abused the offer. And the man was saying, he said, it wasn't that I didn't know that potential was there. He said, I decided to help him in spite of knowing that it was there, in spite of knowing the personality type, in spite of knowing that he was probably going to, you know, take advantage. So then you don't call that taking advantage. You call it making a choice to give a person an opportunity, because who knows? This might be the one time that's a turning point in their life. And then what a great work you will have done in turning a cup that was upside down upright to be filled. Now, so this is something, this, you see what I'm talking about? This is nothing about the head, you know? And we have this idea that this is all about the mind, but the Buddha is talking about an attitude of the mind of the heart. And that's a different thing altogether. And this is the path that we find ourselves on. This is the true path of awakened ones. This is the path of the sage and the mystic. And they are not sages and mystics because they are born different, because they have a greater capacity, but it's because they are willing to be in the fire of transformation and to stay with it until they come out the other side. And then they are useful and they are beneficial. It's choosing the other over oneself. Choosing the other doesn't mean we lose ourselves. I mean, because we're 100% here. We got to give up a whole lot to lose ourselves. But what it does is it balances. You know, we don't have to worry about, you know, going to the extreme, because we are so decidedly for ourselves, even when we don't want to be. It's encoded in our DNA, self-preservation, first law of nature. No. But to be more than that takes a certain training. Are you down for that? That's what we're talking about, the heart of a bodhisattva. And one hand, they say, define a bodhisattva in the Theravada as one destined for awakening, no way to awaken without it. On the other side, in the Mahayana, they define the bodhisattva as the one who hears the cries of the world, but not only hears them, can respond with compassion, but not only compassion, but with compassion and power. And that power comes through the perfection of their practice.